Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester On The Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is another beautiful day. It's Wednesday, February 13th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And we have a special guest. He's always special to me, and because of the subject matter that he delves into. And this is Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's written his latest article is A Message from the Shutdown. I looked at the wrong thing. I can't believe I pulled this one up. This is the one that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago with regard to the shutdown. So let me pull up the exact title. Forgive me. Bear with me a moment. And, I have to get to the other side on this. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe it. I think I made a blunder on my webpage here. Let's just see. I think I have. Well, while I look for that, let me start off with a professor. And first of all, welcome. Good morning. And I'm sorry for my blunder here, but evidently I'll get that corrected in a bit. But you were talking about this whole concept of healthcare, and that we may be looking at it from the wrong perspective. We may be looking at it more from a perspective of what's political. I guess what's politically correct, but just a moral issue as opposed to a labor concern. And what is the difference? Why are we focused only on the moral issue and not on getting a leg up in manufacturing and other things like that so we can become more competitive?
Well, one is you use the language of the workers, the benefit of the workers, as a cover for other priorities. So, you know, you're saying that they become the reason why politically you should have healthcare reform, but the real issue is healthcare reform is really has been couched as a moral issue. We have a right to it. That's the language everybody talks about. It should be our right. Uh-huh. Everybody has a right to this. I hear this all the time, and nobody really asks the obvious question: if it were a positive right, and there's a difference between a negative right and a positive right. A negative right is government can't interfere with your right to obtain, say, health insurance. A positive right would mean the government has an absolute obligation to ensure that you are healthy, that you actually have health care. And so, you know, nobody considers what the implications of a positive right to health care would mean. So what the ACA did was it basically guaranteed access to insurance. That's not the same thing as health care. So if you have the bronze plan and you're able to get through even with subsidies, but you have a $12,000 deductible, then healthcare is still prohibitively expensive for you. Unless you're absolutely sick and in the hospital, you're really not going to go to the doctor too often, given those high deductibles. So,
right.
That's one problem. But if you really had a positive right to healthcare, then would it be incumbent upon the state to say draft people to become doctors? So you can have enjoy your positive right to health care. I mean, if you don't have doctors, you don't have health care. But a positive right means the government has to ensure that you have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, but that's like one side of the equation. And on the other side of the equation, you pointed out that the cost of health insurance has added between $1,500 to $2,000 to the sticker price of an American automobile. And this has been known for, at least 20, 25, 30 years to be the case. And yet we still, you know, plod along as if this isn't an issue, and yet it is an issue, isn't it?
You know, it's an issue that has been adding to the cost of production. It's added to the cost of goods and services, and it has created a competitive disadvantage for American companies, especially when you're competing with countries where healthcare is provided by the state or through some other means, or at least it's detached from the employer. So, you know, most American firms, despite the fact that they cried out rising costs of health care, have not wanted to have, say, a single-payer system. They kind of enjoy being in the driver's seat. They provide the benefits, and they sort of control their workers. And they don't want to lose that kind of control, at least until you had the changes in the Affordable Care Act. I'm not even sure whether those changes still exist, but, you know, with regards to pre-existing conditions, I mean, basically it created job lock. Workers were not free to take other jobs. They may have paid more in terms of money wages for fear they would lose their insurance. And I think to a certain extent that's what employers wanted to be the case. So that way you can keep wages low, and you know that that workers are not going to leave for higher wages elsewhere.
That's because they already have a pre-existing condition. And so I think a lot of people didn't recognize that so much. How do we juxtapose I remember you also wrote about the history of how we came about to, embellish the return of somebody's work by giving them, an extra thing on the side, a benefit beyond their money wages. And why did that come about?
Basically, following World War II, the country was still under price and wage controls, and you had negotiations between the UAW and one of the automakers, it may have been Ford, but the workers could not get higher wages because of the wage and price control. So the manufacturers, auto company, basically offered them health insurance in lieu of. At the time, health insurance was fairly inexpensive. And so, you know, from the company's point of view, it was actually a win-win. They didn't have to pay higher wages, but they did give the workers something. The workers walked away with a benefit. The other ones would have had to purchase on their own. But over time, the cost of providing health care became too exorbitant, and in some cases prohibitive for many employers. So, nevertheless, it became a pattern in bargaining, and it basically spread throughout various industries and basically became the norm. So now employers will provide health insurance, and it's a benefit that we've come to expect. Now, one wonders what might have been the effect had perhaps workers gotten accustomed to buying their own insurance in the free market, in which case you'd have more people in the marketplace purchasing insurance. That means the few insurance companies would actually have to compete with one another for customers. They would actually have to lower their premiums in order to attract customers. But because you have fewer employers in the marketplace bidding down prices, there isn't nearly as much competition.
So I got to ask you, when it comes to, like, for example, the cost of building a car, which is a big ticket item and also a good part of the cost to the manufacturer, if they manufacture in the United States, is between $1,500 and $2,000 per vehicle. How is it that we have a company like BMW? Are they engaging in some sort of an aberration and they want to build even more factories in the United States? Don't they also have to endure that? Or is it just that we're looking at a different price point and they can afford it because their cars cost more than the norm of $25,000, let's say, and their cars may cost $50,000 and $75,000? How does that balance out in their equation, in their thinking?
Well, it is a different price point. It's a different market. Basically, they figure they have a market of people who want high-end cars, specifically want German imports, or German-made kind of cars, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And the competition is not that great. I mean, because, you have Benz, you have Audi, you have, maybe they see themselves competing to a certain extent. Don't really think it's true against, Cadillac and Lincoln Continental, but the market that's going to buy a BMW is going to pay, $50,000 and up. It basically, it's not going to make a difference whether they're paying an additional $2,000 to cover health insurance for BMW workers in the United States.
So how did we get to the point, or who's driving the argument or the discussion in such a way that the public is totally unaware, or seemingly mostly unaware, of how we got to this point and how deleterious it is for us when we want to compete on the international stage and have that disadvantage because we don't have government as the single payer? So why don't we hear that from either the Republican or the Democratic side, other than just mouthing, you know, sweet nothings that go nowhere?
Well, you notice I didn't really advocate specifically for a single payer as opposed to a market-based solution. What I did suggest is that we need to detach insurance from employers. Would be a serious reform. We need to have serious reform in the name of the marketplace and improving the marketplace and America's competitive position. So on the one hand, you have the Democrats who are basically, you know, telling the old argument that we need to have Medicare for all or a single-payer system or government or even socialized medicine. And there are differences between single-payer and socialized medicine.
Okay.
So they're basically talking about that. Then you have the Republicans who are not necessarily offering anything new, but they're simply responding to the Democratic proposals and basically screaming socialism. So therefore, that shuts down all discussion of any possible reform. Republicans are right. The Affordable Care Act has not been what it was cracked up to be, and it has created a lot more problems than people thought, and it certainly has not guaranteed health care as people claim. It has maybe given some people access to insurance that they wouldn't otherwise have, but it's not necessarily the best insurance they could get.
Yeah, well, certainly not when the price tag is a $12,000 deductible. You know, that's not that doesn't give you much health coverage because you probably can't afford it. You can't even afford to go to the doctor with prices like that. So where does this lead us to, and what's holding us back from changing the equation today? Is there a lack of discourse? Is that the problem? Or a lack of perspective by one party or the other? And can there be a meeting of the minds on this issue, or is this going to be another 10-year cycle and we're still going to be immersed in this, whatever, this squabble over how to take care of an aging population as well as even young people who are just growing up and are going to be challenged with other concerns into the future?
Well, there is no discourse on this issue. You know, you do have well-entrenched interests who like the system as it is, particularly insurance companies that make a lot of money on the current system. And it's big business. And billions of dollars are at stake here in terms of profit. So they're not ready to give up their position. And a single-payer system, government-sponsored, would clearly wipe out the insurance industry. And you have all the Democratic candidates on the left talking about how we need to get rid of insurance companies. That's not going to fly with many American voters. I mean, it will fly with the base of the Democratic Party, but it's not going to fly with Republicans. It's not gonna, and it probably won't even fly with independents, whom you have to win over to win an election. So there was even a piece by Bill Galston in the Wall Street Journal this morning talking about how the Democrats are really playing into Republicans' playbook and basically can guarantee Trump a second term if they continue to talk about Medicare for all. It's a trap. He's probably right. It is a trap. If they would talk about Medicare, say, open to all, you know, if some people want to buy into it as an option, that might be more appealing to a lot of voters. And you're not talking about eliminating the current insurance industry. On the other hand, if you had, say, if you detached some insurance from employers and basically allowed workers to buy their own, or if you, instead of employers providing insurance, they simply offered as a benefit vouchers to their workers to purchase on the open marketplace, then the insurance industry would continue to be the insurance industry, but there'd still be more competition in the marketplace, which could help to drive down prices.
So, but we're still at a stalemate at this point. Are the latest, people elected into government office, they're usually millennials and stuff. They've got different concepts. They may only be a small part of government at the moment, but their voices are being heard, and it's rattling the establishment to some extent. What sort of input can we expect from the new batch of elected officials in Congress and in the Senate? Are they on target? Are they aware of the issues as well? Are they explaining it well?
I don't think they're explaining it terribly well. Again, they're basically couching in terms of, the standard tropes. It's our right. American businesses are basically profiting at the expense of the typical worker. It's class warfare in the current system. It's a morality play. I don't think it's going to help. It's not going to win an election. I think, again, I've been arguing this for a long time. If politicians from either party were to talk about what kinds of programs and policies could be of benefit to the middle class, and nobody's going to talk about the middle class, they might actually have a better chance of winning an election. And it's precisely because Trump sounded the populist theme. He talked about how the middle class were, not that he mentioned the middle class, but he basically was alluding to the fact that the middle class was suffering from economic policies in the past and the changing economy, and the fact that you had a Democratic candidate who basically ignored the suffering of these workers, refused to even campaign in blue states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That's why he won.
Yeah. It's really, really, really fascinating. Yeah, it looks like he's more powerful as the option for the next election than any Democrat that I see on the platform out there. So how does one move this equation forward? Voices like you that seem to make sense to me, and there's a greater balance in the way you present your arguments. Is that a difficult road to hoe, and that it's easier to be on one side of the equation or the other because of the special interests on both ends of the spectrum? Is it very hard to be balanced? Is that the problem, that there's little accommodation and no concern for it?
Well, special interests will certainly tip the scales in a particular direction. But I think, party discipline is also playing a role here. Nobody is brave enough to basically say, you know what, Medicare for All is maybe not the answer. Maybe there should be other alternatives. They're afraid if they don't say it, then they don't have a chance of winning the party base. And I think that's the problem. There's no discussion anymore. There's no debate. There's no willingness to critically engage ideas.
But if the party base is going to be disillusioned by a change in perspective, is that because the politicians aren't feeding the base and those that are not part of the base the rationale for changing it? Are we just not doing a good job in communicating with the public anymore?
I don't think we've been doing a good job communicating with the public for years now. The elites that dominate the political discourse see no reason to engage the public. The public, in their minds, are basically deplorable. So they will tell the public what to think, and they will manipulate the public. That's the lesson we've learned going back several decades now in presidential elections.
Yeah, that seems to be the real horror of it all. So it's as if the public and certainly the middle class are just not going to get any headway here. And the dogma that we hear espoused by one group or another is certainly not meeting the needs of the public. Whether on the lowest end of the distribution or on the highest end, probably the only people that are doing well on this are going to be the higher end of the distribution, maybe to some extent some of the lowest end, but the largest majority is not being catered to in any way. How did we get to this point, though? Did we just not realize where we were being led?
Well, I think we always knew we were being led, and I think it's always been the case that special interests had an upper hand in politics and in public policy discussions. And representatives have always catered to special interests, particularly those who make campaign contributions. And the American public has always been manipulated. But to a certain extent, as long as the economy was growing and people's wages were rising and people felt comfortable, they were sort of willing to sort of look the other way and say, it doesn't bother me.
So are we going through some sort of a revolution, or are we still very much in slumber and we're just leaving everything alone because we don't know what to do and there is no direction? Are there any even politicians on the platform that are saying what's appropriate? And are they getting resonance, or is that not happening either?
I don't see any politicians saying anything at this point, which bucks the standard trope on the left in the Democratic Party. Medicare for all, single-payer system, government-sponsored healthcare, whatever. I don't see anybody in the Republican side offering a viable alternative. You know, they talked about repealing the Affordable Care Act, but they never really offered a proposal which would improve it. The whole idea is just gut it and then move on. The only possibility, I suppose, and I don't really know much about them, is you do have the former CEO of Starbucks, who I don't know if he's declared yet or not, but you know, if he talks about running as independent, he's already made it clear that he rejects socialism and basically has basically called, basically dismissed, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's, green energy plan as basically a socialist blueprint. He's also rejected the Medicare for All idea, and basically, so you have a potential for somebody who has, you know, moderate to slightly left to center views on social issues, but who clearly has moderate to right of center views on economic policy. And so there, I think, is where you may have a compromise, but third parties don't usually win presidential elections.
Don't.
It's a tough road to hoe.
Yeah, definitely not. But it is interesting that he's taking a slightly different position. But what is the infatuation with Americans with regard to socialism? Is it a lack of knowledge of what socialism was? Do people understand how socialism worked and how it failed? Is the free enterprise system going to be eclipsed by socialism? You see socialism having failed in a lot of countries, and people have stepped away from it because, you know, it doesn't really work. It's been proven not to work.
Well, people don't understand that's true. But they also, what they do understand is they're not doing terribly well in today's economy, and their needs are not being met. And they do see the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And that was clearly a diagnosis that socialists made earlier on. That was a justification for a revolution. A few people own the means of production, and basically they're exploiting workers, and American workers understand that they are being exploited. So on the one hand, socialism basically would give control, absolute control to government to make decisions regards to how we live our lives. But in the minds of many American workers, especially low-wage workers, they're already being controlled by employers who are exploiting them. So it's not really to be trading one oppressive class for another oppressive class, but it may be potentially better in the minds of some. At least they would have health care and a few other things that would be guaranteed. But they don't understand is that it could also lead to externalities, unintended consequences, which could be devastating to their lives in the long term.
And when we look at the cost of health care, is that an artificial cost increase, or is that really that really a correct increase, because that's how everything has been moving forward in the U.S. because costs are rising. And why did that come about?
Look,
it's
costs
so unaffordable.
Costs rise for a variety of reasons, but if you want the most advanced technologies, then that adds costs to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Drop that one. MRIs, you want other tests which are very expensive, which may be
mm-hmm.
needed. That adds significantly to the cost. What also adds to the cost, which nobody has addressed, is the absence of tort reform. The fact that a lot of doctors order a lot of tests which may not be needed for fear that they're
mm-hmm.
going to be sued. Now you didn't get tort reform from the last Congress to pass the Affordable Care Act, because you basically had a Congress comprised mostly of trial lawyers, so they would never have tort reform. So that's a serious issue. But the point is, when you're ordering a CAT scan in the emergency room for everybody who comes in for fear that you'll be
mm-hmm.
sued because you didn't order one, you're adding tremendously to the cost of health care, and nobody takes that into account. But, again, if you listen to the socialists and the morality play, it's obviously the greedy hospitals and the greedy doctors. That's
mm-hmm.
not really what's driving healthcare costs at this point.
Right. I to be honest with you, I remember tort reform was ran through a cycle and evidently was beaten to death maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and I haven't heard the word tort reform in so long. So thanks for bringing it up. You reminded me of some of the basic issues, and I didn't realize that. I didn't really remember that was part of the problem with healthcare costs, which is interesting. Is there where do we go from here when we're stuck in a situation that is not functioning? Healthcare is a problem. It shouldn't be spoken about from a moral perspective, but probably would be better off if we spoke about it about manufacturing capacity and competitive capacity as well on the world stage, or are we separating it so that we don't have to really contend with it? So maybe are we giving up, for example, the lower end of the car manufacturing? So are we only looking at a Hyundai or a Kia? Is that the only place for us to go? And it's almost unaffordable for Ford even to be in that segment anymore. So we're now elevating car manufacturers to the $35,000 to $50,000 range, and then $50,000 to $75,000 and $75,000 and up. But that's unsustainable as well, isn't it?
Well, it's unsustainable if American wages don't rise, and that's certainly the case. So, yeah, if a low-wage worker is basically, if they want a new car, they sort of are forced into the Hyundai market.
Yeah. Wow. So, because I was always in shock, for example, that the Korean manufacturers were allowed to enter into the U.S. market. They were so inexpensive. And that it was one thing to keep them at a very low level, but then to allow them to move up the food chain, where now they've got vehicles that they're selling that part of the operation for $75,000. And they also still have that leg up because they don't have to pay the cost of health insurance that adds to their bottom line. Where do we go? Are we just stuck? Are we going to be stuck like this for a while? Another 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, that seems to be the nature of American politics. So unless you have a serious crisis that basically drives change, it doesn't come about. But again, you have talking points for an election. Again, nobody's talking about raising people's wages. Nobody's talking about addressing income inequality in a serious way. Nobody's talking about the disappearance of the middle class. They're talking about, an issue. It's not unimportant, but basically it's sort of on the fringes of the economy. And they really don't explain how it affects the economy in a larger manner. And that you're not getting from any of the candidates.
So is this indicative that we're now going to, we talk a good game about trying to bring a population together to lessen the disparity of wealth and capacity among our population. But at the end of the day, we're just creating those that are better off and those that are less well off. And that's where the divide is going to stay. And we're not going to be moving ahead in any way, including the new people like the Ocasio-Cortez crew that may be coming in. They have nice words to say, but little capacity to move it forward. And they're espousing socialist concepts that have proven eventually in time in other countries not to have worked, and only to diminish the capacity of those countries to function. And that the creative forces that you would expect from a free market economy are just, they get beaten to death. And so everything stays the same. So are we going there? Are we dividing our nation between poor and rich?
Well, the nation's been divided between poor and rich for quite some time now, and nobody's willing to own up to that fact. But apparently, you have politicians who are willing to play the class warfare. You know, it's not just AOC who's playing that card. It's also Elizabeth Warren is playing that card, and several others who are basically making these same arguments. I think what you have, especially when you have a self-styled, described socialist candidate who basically says, I'm a socialist, I'm proud of it, she has a following, and particularly on social media, and she uses this as a reason, a way to build her base of support, and nobody sees her for the false messiah that she probably is. She really has not, this basically the emperor with no clothes. There's really nothing there. If you're attracting low-wage workers and other millennials who feel like they're not doing as well as their parents' generation, then they have some serious concerns. And basically, the appeal to take it, to stick it to the rich and take it away from them to give it to the poor sounds great. It's a great rallying cry, and it may help them win an election. Once you actually get into nitty-gritty of politics, it doesn't work. You can't get things done. And this is what people don't seem to understand. And she's basically saying, if I make a moral argument and I shout it loud enough from the rooftops and I can get people to wake up and listen, we'll have change. Mm-hmm. Well, no, we won't. Because you have to get down into nitty-gritty of politics and work with one another and compromise. And you have divergent interests. That's how Congress works. And once they find out how Congress really works, then they throw up their hands and say, I had no idea what was involved. Right. We just can't accomplish much of anything.
Something very interesting that just came about. Amazon was going to open up two headquarters for a think tank of their own, you know, people who would work on evolving the Amazon product line, how to make it more efficient and so on and so forth. And there was going to be then two headquarters. I don't remember where the second one was, but the first one that interested me, of course, was what was going on in Queens, in Long Island City. And headquarter two was going to be situated there. And then there was a big concern after the governor said, you know, we're going to invest $3 billion as an inducement to get Amazon to come to New York. And then all of a sudden, I heard that Andrea Stewart-Cousins, who is the head of the New York State Senate, and she's the majority leader, and then Carl Heastie from the Assembly, he's the speaker. These are the two leaders that are in the room with the governor. In order to become independent of the governor, they said, they weren't going to go with the whole idea of giving a $3 billion inducement. But the governor proved that, or at least he postulated, maybe it wasn't proven for some people, he postulated that there would be a return of $27 billion to the economy over time. And isn't that where we miss the boat quite often? Because there is a financial component, and then it would be a benefit. Why is it, it seems like this was also a battle to stick it to the rich, because why should the richest man in the world, worth $108 billion last I saw, be getting a $3 billion inducement, even if we get $27 billion in the deal? Is this part of where we're going?
This has been the paradox of urban development and redevelopment for many decades now. You know, on one hand, you know, public officials have a need to represent their immediate constituents, those who vote for them, and many of whom may be middle class and poor, and many of whom really need jobs. And they need to, on the other hand, in order to represent them, they have to attract investment dollars to their particular domains. Attracting investment dollars basically means you're now courting outside interests, people who didn't vote for you, but you basically are courting them to get them to invest in your either your state or your locality. So you end up offering them various inducements to do so. What you have here, and the other location was Alexandria, Virginia, but what you have here is a situation whereby it's not clear that the workers who will benefit immediately are those who really need jobs the most, those who are not making decent livings. The job, the workers
probably
are going
not.
To be right. The jobs who are
right.
people
because
are
they're
really
earning $150,000 a year.
Right. The workers who are really going to earn do well are basically highly skilled, in college educated workers, basically in the STEM fields. So they're going to do well and they're going to have jobs. And then the concern is because you're attracting this investment, you're going to attract people from all over the world now to work at Amazon, basically to employ people from outside New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to come to live in the environs of New York City. They are,
right.
If they don't live in Queens, they're going to live in Long Island or wherever. But you're going to then drive up the prices of real estate and rents in those areas and push poorer people out to the fringes. So then they get hurt at the expense. So basically, the wealthy, the middle class and wealthy prosper at the expense of the poor. And that's really what happens in many of these cases. On the other hand, in the long term, it does benefit the state and locality that basically offered these incentives. But it's uneven in terms of the benefits, uneven distribution of benefits to the populace. That's what's going on with the opposition to Amazon.
So I can understand that and appreciate it, but then where does one go? No one's making an investment of any kind to move 25,000 jobs into Queens or anywhere else. And that's what I could never understand. If Congress, if the government didn't want to have these sort of inducements given, why don't we just simply outlaw inducements? You want to invest, you invest. If you don't want to, that's okay, so you don't. But why do we permit this con game? It's like it's either yes or no. And then the return, wouldn't there be a ripple effect if you've got 25,000 people moving into Queens that are earning $150,000? They have to live somewhere. They have to eat somewhere. They have to buy clothing. They go shopping. They'll probably order from Amazon much of the stuff because, you know, they're going to be loyal to the company. But so how is it supposed to work? Or don't we know that?
Look, I suppose you could outlaw inducements if they weren't, if you didn't have all these loopholes and deductions in the tax code that favored moneyed interest. if you had a flatter tax code, it would be a little easier to do that. And then you could say, look, this is the tax rates. You want to invest, invest. If you don't want to invest, don't invest. But we're not going to encourage you. We're not going to use the tax code for purposes of social engineering. This is precisely what we do with the tax code right now. If you had a simple tax code, which had a flat rate or even several flat rates for progressivity's sake, then, you know, it would be a whole different discussion.
Mm-hmm. So we just have to await the process to evolve, and either people that we elect into office will get it or they won't. And is there a way to serve the people at the lower end of the distribution and those in the higher end? And are we awaiting the whole process to change because of our capacity to educate our population? Is that the factor that's causing a lot of this divide? It's all a financial capacity, and it probably was always that way, financial capacity. The rich did very well, and they didn't suffer as much as the people at the poorer end. So how do we bring that together, or is there no way to bring that together?
Again, it's hard to make changes, fundamental changes, when there's so many interests at stake, and moneyed interests are basically making contributions to campaigns in one form or another.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult for members of Congress to vote against their own respective self-interest just in the name of creating a greater equitable society. You know,
right.
It's sort of like asking the Israeli parliament to lower its thresholds to get seats in the parliament. You know, that goes against the interests of smaller parties than because they are become part of the coalition. They would lose that position as deal makers in the coalition if you actually did that. But it would give the majority parties an edge. But it would say, we don't need you. And basically, it's the same kind of thing. They're not going to vote against their self-interest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. So, and how do the other economists in the U.S., how do they look at all this? Do they have solutions, or are they just giving notice of what's happening on the economic stage and the reaction of business and government to it? Are we getting different opinions nowadays, or is that still not evident?
Yeah, the opinions of economists have always been there, and they're basically they're trying to explain people's behavior and how they respond to the various stimuli and policy decisions that are made. But basically, you know, economists, you have a group that basically supports a single payer system. You know, for a variety of reasons, not least of which is it would end job lock and basically could add to America's competitive position. You have another group of economists who believe that, you know, maybe we should detach healthcare from the from employers and basically have people basically purchase their own insurance, whether they get vouchers from employers or whether they're doing it on their own. But the other thing to keep in mind is if you detach from employers, so they don't have that as part of the wage, it's not no longer part of the workers' wage bill they're paying. It is possible that money wages could rise for workers, which would be a benefit to the economy too. So nobody's really focused on that question. It certainly would not compensate completely from what they lost, but if their money wages rise, then employees would be able to more ably afford insurance on their own, or they can afford to pay a higher tax for a single payer system. So that's something to keep in mind. Then you have another group of economists who talk about maybe, and this is where the Republicans have made proposals in the past, but nobody never gotten too far, and that is to basically tax benefits, fringe benefits, as though they're actually income. And the logic of this is, and it's not clear why this would work, but the logic of this is if you're an employee and your health insurance benefits are being taxed as though it's income, then you'll be more engaged as a consumer in trying to push down prices. in the marketplace.
Oh.
So
wow.
that goes the argument. I don't know how
right.
it would work, and I'm not entirely sure it would work, but that's the thinking.
Okay. Wow. So I don't know where we go with this. It's just a fact, and it's a reality, and it looks like it's going to be a slow move, if at all. How do we compare, for example, when we talk about health insurance and how do we compare, for example, with the Canadian system where they have a national health plan? And we demonize them because they say everybody's waiting in line to get health insurance, health care, and they made it sound like people with heart disease are going to be waiting 3 months before they're even looked at. Are those truisms, or are they just scare tactics?
Well, partly it's true, and partly it's scare tactics, and people
mm-hmm.
don't realize that people can wait 3 months to see a heart specialist in this country, too, if you're a new patient and
yeah.
you've been referred to somebody. So it could be 3 months
mm-hmm.
till somebody has an opening, so you're waiting just
right.
as long. That's something that's not easily understood in this country. What you have in Canada is, you know, each province is allotted a certain number of procedures during a particular quarter. So, you know, if Ontario, for example, uses up its quota of colonoscopies, then
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to wait in Ontario to next quarter to get a colonoscopy. If Quebec, however, has not used up its quota of colonoscopies, it can actually trade with Ontario. So, you know,
oh, wow.
it's possible to get something sooner. But that's how the system works. There is, in some ways, that is regarded as a form of rationing. And I think, you know, it would be a mistake not to understand that if you invite the government in to health care in the form of Medicare
mm-hmm.
for all, there will, in fact, be rationing. At
yeah.
some point, you have to address the question, can we afford to pay for expensive life-saving procedures at the end
mm-hmm.
of life, which is not going to necessarily save their life, may prolong their life for another year or two, but
yeah.
the quality of life will be greatly diminished. And we have to address
mm-hmm.
whether that's a good expense of money. In Britain, which is socialized medicine, and the difference is that all doctors, nurses are employees of the government. Hospitals are
mm-hmm.
run by the government. And basically, you do have clear rationing. So a person who's 75 years old who needs open heart or triple bypass surgery is not going to get it. Because the
uh-huh.
calculations, this person has lived a nice life. It's time to invest the resources into younger people who have not.
Mm-hmm.
They've recently discovered in Israel a possible cure for cancer.
Right.
The treatment is like $1 million. And they're basically, and while the government's willing to pay for it, but they're not willing to pay for people who need it who are over 25. Now, you know,
okay.
they're basically saying, they're making a calculation, who should we put the money into? Where's a good
right.
They spend that kind of money. What's a good investment? And those are decisions that are going to be made. What Americans don't understand is when you decry the single-payer system and socialized medicine for its rationing, you have rationing already in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, insurance companies are already saying, we're not going to pay for certain procedures
right.
over a certain point. But for some reason, we seem to think that's okay. Because the government's
mm-hmm.
not rationing, but basically a panel of MBAs, along with some
mm-hmm.
nurse practitioners,
rationing.
Are rationing, when you don't include any doctors in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I'm just—it's just flabbergasting that we're just not moving ahead on this a little bit differently. And how is it, for example, that what we're charging for medicine here in the United States is somehow subsidized on the world stage? Is that another issue as well? Because we want to be magnanimous, they may be paying very little for a drug in anywhere else outside of the United States, and yet here we're paying much higher prices. And why is that? shouldn't it cost the same in Canada or in England or in South Africa or in Japan and or in Argentina? Shouldn't it be the same price?
It should be, and if you had a true market system, one would even be able to purchase drugs from Canada, Japan, or wherever it happens to be cheaper.
And
basically, you know, you have a system whereby the drug industry says we want to be able to maintain certain price levels that justifies our investment into research and development for finding new drugs to deal with certain problems, issues. They may not be completely wrong, but unless you have a budget coming from government to make those kinds of investments into those kinds of that kinds of research, the drug companies are going to be able to use these arguments. And again, they're a powerful industry and they're a powerful lobby. And so basically what you have is a regime in which, you know, prices are set by the insurance companies in consultation with government agencies. And then when, like the insurance, auto insurance market, basically they want to get premiums. Basically some state insurance commission allows them to raise their rates throughout the state.
Yeah.
Basically you have the same idea concept going on where insurance commissions in states are also allowing health insurance companies to do exactly the same thing, to raise the rates, and it's happening with the Affordable Care Plan. So,
wow, amazing, just truly amazing. Well, there are just so many facets to all of this; it's hard to pin it down. it really is. This is like a can of worms, and I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, actually. But maybe it's a good nutrient, all those worms. But so I guess this will just fester until we eventually get to some sort of process that will lead us towards a solution. But that could take weeks and years and decades and who knows how long. And but there, do you see a crisis that would bring about a change, or is that like really untellable? It's not something that we could even conjecture. What could conceivably happen that we would change a policy like these that we're discussing now?
You know, you have enough people who can't get insurance, some people who are not getting access to health care because the deductibles are too high. Enough hospitals are closing down because they no longer can afford to see Medicaid patients without being reimbursed. Think of a whole thing. The economy goes into a tailspin and more people lose their jobs and they lose their insurance, which is employer-based.
Right.
All these things can happen. Again, as long as the economy is doing well, then there's less of there's a perception out there. There's less of a need to make any substantive changes.
But you bring up a good point, though. You bring up a lot of good points, but this point like really strikes home. There's so much consolidation going on in the health industry. Hospitals are merging in order to cut their costs. Eventually, that they're not going to be saving any money, and they're going to be stuck with the economic issues that confront them now. So maybe they can't do it as an individual hospital, but they can manage it when there are four or five of them all grouped up together. But that too will eventually run its course. And the economy doesn't look like it's necessarily getting any better because of so many tariffs and tariff wars and so on and so forth. Is it conceivable that we're creating our own crisis, and we just don't see it yet?
Well, I don't know if we're creating our own crisis yet, but I think, you know, we don't understand the connections between different sectors of the economy. There's just an interconnectedness, and that's what we don't necessarily grasp. So we're sort of treating healthcare as though it's separate from the economy. It's separate from the labor market. It's really part of the labor market. But we're sort of treating it's out there as a different issue. And since when you get right down to it, the Democrats, in so many respects, have no economic platform to run on. They're going to talk about how lousy the economy is, but the economy, by all objective measures, is doing better than it was before. So they have to run on some morality play, or quite simply, identity politics. This morality play is another form of identity politics. You know, people who are disadvantaged, who have been oppressed and whatnot. And healthcare is a classic example of how they've been oppressed, and we have to represent them. And so this gives voice to the Ocasio-Cortez of the world, and now people who feel they have to out Ocasio-Cortez in order to become president. They're all doing the same thing. They're all saying the same thing. And so what the difference is between the candidates and the Democratic Party, I don't know at this point.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, Professor, as usual, thank you very much. I found the article that you wrote. It's called Healthcare Reform is Essential for the American Labor Market, of course, by Orrin M. Levin-Walden. Thank you very much. I'm going to cover some of the books that you've written and give a quick bio of you so that people recognize it. I'm sorry I just didn't have it before. So enjoy the week, and we'll speak to you eventually. I look forward to it always. Thank you so much. Always a learning experience.
Thank you.
Be well, sir. Well, there we are, folks. Orrin M. Levin-Waldman is a PhD. He's a professor at the Graduate School for Public Affairs and Administration at the Metropolitan College of New York. He's the research scholar at the Binziger Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, also a faculty member in the Milana School for International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy in the New School. And he's written quite a few books, which I think you'll find quite compelling, which also goes to the gist of so many of the issues that he brings forward. One of the first was Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage. Orrin M. Levin-Waldman is the author. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and the book makes the case for minimum wage as a way to improve well-being of middle-class workers, middle-income workers, and reduce income inequality and enhance democracy. Another book that he published is called Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook. It's published by ABC-CLIO. And the Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, goes into the time as of 2014 when the minimum wage in Seattle became $15 an hour, which was double the federal minimum wage. And evidently, it did not rattle the world, and evidently, it worked. Another publication, which is now also in paperback, is his book, Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, again, by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. There is a review on the book itself. It's published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Routledge, and you could find them at Routledge.com. And you could find a review, if you'd like, to look up in Yonkers Tribune, and just simply look up Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, Levin-Waldman, and you'll be able to find more information about that. Well, I want to quickly go to our studio screen. Bear with me a moment, and here we are. Okay. Let me just bear with me a second here. This is very interesting. I'm going to go to the page in a moment, but this just showed up on Twitter. It seems that Chris Christie last night said that he thinks there's a 2% chance that Trump decides he will have accomplished more in 3 years than any president in history and decides not to run in 2020. So we're going to have to see if that's right. This was noted by Axios, A-X-I-O-S, and they were the ones that issued the tweet. So that's going to be very interesting to see where that goes. Now, What else did I want to point out to you? Yes, I wanted to just check to see with you who's going to be on tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be speaking to John and Lori Wiles. They're part of the Driving Me Crazy crowd. And hopefully we'll also be able to speak to Win Morrow. He's the automotive reviewer. And then I expect that we'll be speaking to Mayor Richard Thomas of Mount Vernon. And I guess that'll be pretty much it. So we'll see what we're doing there. I don't remember exactly which car we're going to be doing tomorrow. And I think actually it's the Hyundai Ioniq, which is interesting. Very interesting because it's a car with three different models of three different types of propulsion. One's in energy, electric energy, the other's gas, the other's something else. I'm not quite sure what they all are, but we'll be discussing that tomorrow. So let me quickly go back and check what's happening on our studio screen. And what we'll do is we'll take a quick break, find out what they're doing at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezzy Aris. If you do want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, you could certainly get them at another number, 347-415-4326. So that's 347-415-4326. And you can use that number to text them, to leave a message, a voicemail, or it's also the cell phone and the office number. So you can use that one number, 347-415-4326. Now, let me just quickly look at something else here. This is a very interesting because it speaks to anti-Semitism, and this time we're going to be able to look at it from the French perspective and get insight into what the government in France said, announced, they announced that there's an anti-Semitic acts had soared by 74% in 2018. So we're going to end up listening to some of the issues brought forward on this and listen in. And we're going to listen to a rabbi being interviewed on France 24, and we'll be right back.
This week in France, the government announced that anti-Semitism was on the rise, up 74% over the course of 1 year. The most recent incidents saw swastikas sprayed, painted over portraits of Holocaust survivor Simone Veil, and the word Jew written across a shop window. France's interior minister says anti-Semitism is spreading like a poison, attacking the French Republic. To give us her perspective on that, and indeed tell us about her new book, Reflections on the Question of Anti-Semitism, we're joined on set by one of France's three female rabbis, Ms. Delphine Horvilla. Thanks so much for your time. Given the week that's in it, Ms. Horvilla, can I start by just asking you, how do you read those frightening figures coming from the French government?
Yeah, we heard yesterday this number, 74, that you just reminded us. You know, these numbers are terrifying. At the same time, they mean nothing. I mean, never know exactly how to translate that number. When I heard it, I immediately thought we are precisely 74 years after the end of the war. Weird coincidence. It means nothing again, but except help us remind how much we lost memory and people don't learn anything, actually. We know, and we know this for so many years and centuries, actually, that anti-Semitism is always a kind of prelude to a general violence, generally when the Jews are struck somewhere, when there are attacks against Jews. It always means that very, very soon, the rest of the population is going to be attacked, because the Jews always represent the scapegoat, of course, but the first figure of what we call in French altérité, otherness. They are the symbol of what's generally a society in a breach, a society in a state of failure cannot stand. So immediately they are pushed away or attacked, and it says something about a general violence that is about to be on the rise in a society, actually. It's a very warning sign.
And given that you've studied so much the question, why do you think that, you know, Jews are the first ones to be targeted when society is getting fed up in general?
I think that Jews do represent at the same time the same and the other. On this matter, anti-Semitism is quite different from racism. Very often we put them in the same package, I would say. And when I say they're different, obviously I'm not saying that one is more in a hierarchy, is, you know, more serious than the other. I mean, they come from kind of different mindsets in a way. Racism is a lot about accusing the other of being less than me, whereas anti-Semitism is very often accusing the Jew of being more than me, meaning the Jew is what I should be, he has what I should have. So in a way, it's kind of, you know, it's a way of, it's a complex of inferiority, but also it says something about what the Jew represents. The Jew, generally, for the anti-Semitic mind, I would say, or psyche, the Jew represents both someone who is close to me but different from me. Jews have been accused of being different, behaving differently, but at the same time being too much just like myself. You know, a few years ago in France, there was a terrifying phenomenon. When you were Googling something on the internet, it didn't matter which name you were typing, immediately the word Jewish would appear, because it was clear that the research, you know, that very often people were researching a name and wanted to know if that person was or was not Jewish, as if, you know, tracking the Jew was a kind of a national sport. You know, people wanted to
something unique to France, you know, a country that likes to say it's a very secular state.
Yeah.
You know, is that idea of secular state and not being allowed to be publicly religious, is that a help or a hindrance at this stage?
Yeah, I don't think it's particular to France. It has been very strong in France in recent years, but you need to be aware of the fact that France has a very particular story in its relationship to the Jews, undoubtedly. France is the country where Jews were the first to be emancipated after the French Revolution. It's the first country that gave the Jews that right. It's the first country that put a Jew, Léon Blum, in the 30s at the head of the state. But at the same time, France is the country of the Dreyfus Affair, and France is the country of Vichy and collaboration. So in the French history, there is a weird love-hate relationship with the Jews. I come from a family where the love for France is very, very strong and historical. But at the same time, there is a very strong memory of these scars in history.
Complicated relationship. But as you say, this idea of the Jew is more, that is more widespread than France. Where do you think that comes from?
I think it's pretty much everywhere today, but I think the tensions have been very, very strong in recent years in France. So you could point to different factors, maybe. Some people point to the factor of the Arab-Jewish tensions in France that is very maybe specific to this country, but I think it wouldn't be a right direction to look at. I simply think that in recent years in France, when anti-Semitism was on the rise, especially at the beginning of year 2000, it took a long time for the government and for the media to be able to verbalize that it was anti-Semitism. It's as if people had a hard time putting that word, verbalizing even the name anti-Semitism. At the time, the Jewish population in France felt very lonely because they were experiencing anti-Semitism on the rise, but no one was talking about it. And it took, unfortunately, many terrible dates, like Toulouse and Ilan Halimi's assassination, slowly to be able to verbalize the phenomenon.
Because it's strange, you say it took a long time to acknowledge that anti-Semitism, because in your book, you look at ancient religious texts, and it seems like the idea of anti-Semitism came about almost
at the same time as the word Jew. Tell us more about that. So I decided in my book, actually, no, there are many books about anti-Semitism, obviously, books about history or the economy, the sociology or the psychoanalysis of anti-Semitism. I try to look at it through a rabbinic lens, like through Jewish text. How do Jewish texts consider or think about the hate the Jews were victims of? It doesn't mean the Jews have to, in their literature, to explain anti-Semitism, but it's always interesting to think how Jewish literature and religious literature has tried to analyze this phenomenon and in which conditions it comes forward in the society. When you study Jewish texts, you realize that actually when the very word Jewish appears in the Bible, the word Jew appears in the book of Esther, in one of the biblical books, and in the very same chapter appears the first anti-Semite in the Bible. So the rabbis, actually the commentators, suggest that when the Jews and the anti-Semites actually appear together, and in a way they warn us, they tell us, don't even imagine you're going to get rid of anti-Semitism in history. Don't even imagine you're going to be able to make this phenomenon and this hate disappear, but just be able to recognize in which condition it appears and what you can do to make sense in a way of your history, in a way that you're not going to be simply a victim, but something in you is going to be able to be resilient, you know, going to be able to stand up. And I think this, for me, it was very important to write a book that wouldn't be a Jewish book or simply a theology book, but a book for everybody, for non-Jews and for Jews, because I think this phenomenon of resilience is particularly meaningful today in a time of victimhood competition.
Victimhood competition, very briefly, tell us more about that and what it is.
Well, we seem to experience in this time, not only in France, not only in Europe, but pretty much everywhere in the world, the victimhood competition in a way that it seems that people today really feel that having suffered or coming from a group or a family that defines itself as having suffered gives you a kind of noblesse, you know, gives you a kind of special status. And this is crazy, but we experience it pretty much everywhere in the world, you know. And I think in this time of competition of victimhood, it's not a mystery that anti-Semitism is always on the rise in this moment, because Jews very often appear to, their suffering appears to take too much room in a way. They appear to be the absolute victim. And if you want to claim you're the true victim, so what do you do with the Jewish suffering? So I think in this time of competition, we really need to be able to struggle, and especially to teach what resilience is about, what it means to stand up.
Fascinating text, Ms. Delphine Horvida. Thanks so much for giving us your insight into the current situation here in France, and indeed reflections on that question of anti-Semitism. Thank you.
Wow, very, very interesting. I hope you enjoyed that. It's just another learning experience, which will be really quite interesting to say the least. Now, let me just quickly look to see what else is going on in our neck of the woods when it comes to international news and stuff. Well, this is really disturbing because it continues to be repeated over years and years and years, and that is that we find that there are several people that are dead. Dozens have escaped a prison amid protests in Haiti. And at least six people have died in nearly a week-long protest that's demanding that President Jovenel Moïse resign in Haiti, which saw fresh tensions and a major prison break on Tuesday. All 78 detainees at the prison in Akin, A-Q-U-I-N, a city of around 100,000 on the south coast of the country's Tiburon Peninsula, escaped around midday, a national police spokesman had said. And the exact circumstances of the prison break are unclear, but witnesses said it took place during an anti-Moïse demonstration in front of the police station adjoining the penitentiary. Now, Moïse is the French way for Moses, and that's where the name comes from. So some 120 miles north of the prison, Port-au-Prince, also saw clashes between police and hundreds of those in working class neighborhoods. Thousands of people took to the streets after police forces dispersed them. Some set fire to cars and looted stores to express their mounting frustrations over growing social inequalities worsened by systematic corruption. And systemic corruption, rather. A youth was also shot dead at a crossroads near the presidential palace. The former French colony is in the grip of a political crisis that has seen citizens demonstrate in the capital of Port-au-Prince and elsewhere over the last week to demand Moïse's resignation. And barricades have sprung up in some areas of the capital and other cities with protesters demanding the president answer reports of mismanagement and possible embezzlement of development funds in the impoverished Caribbean nation. Police only provided a toll after the first day of nationwide protests on February 7th, with two killed on the sidelines of the marches. And since then, Agence France-Presse has counted four other people shot dead. Amid the degradation in security conditions, the U.S. State Department ordered all minor children of diplomats posted at the American Embassy in Haiti to leave the country. In a statement, the agency also approved the authorized departure of adult family members and non-emergency U.S. personnel. Prison conditions in Haiti are considered to be among the most inhumane in the world by human rights groups. Detainees face extremely crowded conditions, poor hygiene, food shortages, and a lack of health care. The justice system is notoriously slow and has been blamed for contributing to the crisis. In October, an investigation found that three-quarters of the 11,839 people imprisoned in Haiti were still waiting for a court ruling, a delay that has sometimes stretched beyond a decade. So demonstrators are demanding Moïse quit over a scandal centering on the Petrocaribe Fund, under which Venezuela supplied Haiti with and other Caribbean and Central American countries with oil at cut-rate prices and on easy credit terms for years. The president lied to us. These promises of giving us work so we can finally have money to buy food was just bluffing, said Vanel Luis Powell, who joined protesters demanding change. Look, he's been in power for 2 years, and people are starving now more than ever. If Jovenel won't go, we will make the bourgeoisie that supported him suffer so it understands. Adding to the mounting frustration, investigations have shown that nearly $2 billion from the program were misused. A report released in January on the misuse of the money also named a company that was then headed by Moïse as a beneficiary of funds from a road construction project that never had a signed contract. During his election campaign, Moïse promised, quote, food on every plate and money in every pocket. Yet most Haitians still struggle to make ends meet and face inflation that has risen 15% since his election. A mediation group composed of a senior official from the United Nations, Brazil, and a coalition of Western nations has called on Haiti's politicians to enter dialogue over the crisis, lamenting the loss of life and damage caused by the protests. So while the government has offered no response to the demands of demonstrators, opposition groups have also failed to spell out any concrete solution to the crisis beyond calling for the president to step aside. So that's not the way it can work or make any sense that it will work. So that's going to be very interesting, to say the least. Now, let's go back and see what else is happening in our neck of the woods. And bear with me a moment. This is really a mind blower. This is breaking news. Evidently, a suicide attack in southeast Iran has killed 20 members of the elite Revolutionary Guard. We'll learn more about that as it comes in. So, one second. One second here. Oh, this is really quite important. Guaido from Venezuela announced a date for aid to enter Venezuela. Seems that Juan Guaido, the Venezuelan opposition leader and self-proclaimed acting president, announced today, it was actually yesterday, that desperately needed humanitarian aid would be brought into the country on February 23rd, despite opposition from President Nicolas Maduro. U.S. aid has been piling up in Colombia at the border with Venezuela, but until now, the bridge border crossing has been barricaded by the military under Maduro's order. Guaido, who declared himself acting president last month, announced the date at a rally by tens of thousands of opposition supporters to pressure the military to allow in the aid. He asked 250,000 people who signed up as volunteers to organize themselves over the weekend because we're going to have to go in caravans. So we have almost 300,000 Venezuelans who will die if the aid doesn't enter. There are almost 2 million at health risk, said Guaido, recognized as Venezuela's interim leader by 50 countries. Maduro has denounced the aid as a U.S. orchestrated show to overthrow his socialist government and said it will not be let into the country. He has demanded instead that Washington lift economic sanctions. On Tuesday, Guaido said he was issuing a direct order to the armed forces to allow the aid in, though so far there are not clear signs the military will disobey Maduro. So we're going to have to find out where that goes and hopefully be a positive situation rather than a negative one. Wanted to go over and look at one more thing just to make sure that we've covered as much as possible with you. Well, just so you know, it's not the most important thing, but Mexico's notorious drug lord El Chapo was found guilty in a U.S. trial. So that's going to be quite compelling. We'll learn more about that, but no point in engaging in some analysis with regard to that. And bear with me a moment. Okay, we're going to go to the Middle East later because we'll find out what's happening in Iran. Hopefully we'll be able to do so before our time allotment is out. And so I wanted to go over to what's happening in Europe first. Oh, this is interesting. Again, here too, we spoke about it in France. Anti-Semitic attacks rose sharply in Germany in 2018, a report has said. So let's look into this and see what the situation is in Germany. Anti-Semitic offenses rose almost 10% in Germany last year, and violent attacks were up more than 60%, crime statistics show today. Police recorded 1,646 offenses motivated by hatred against Jews, said a government answer to a request by far-left Die Linke, that means the left party, lawmaker Petra Pau. Among these were 62 violent offenses that left 43 people injured, up from 37 physical attacks the previous year. Germany, like other Western countries, has watched with alarm as anti-Semitic and other violence have increased in recent years as the political climate has coarsened and grown more polarized. A mass influx of mostly Muslim refugees and migrants in Germany from 2015 drove the rise of the far right and anti-immigration Alternative für Deutschland party, which since late 2017 is the biggest opposition group in parliament. Leading Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, aside from railing against Islam and multiculturalism, have also made comments that play down the Holocaust. Party co-leader Alexander Gauland described Nazi Germany's industrial scale murder of Jews and other minorities as a mere speck of bird poo in over 1,000 years of successful German history. Another leading Alternative für Deutschland politician, Björn Höcke, has criticized the sprawling Holocaust Memorial in Berlin as a monument of shame. The president of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, Josef Schuster, and other Jewish community leaders have accused the Alternative für Deutschland of fomenting hate against refugees, Muslims, and Jews. At the same time, Germany has also witnessed a rise in anti-Semitic attacks committed by migrants from Arab states. In one prominent case last year, a 19-year-old Syrian man was convicted for assault after lashing out with his belt at an Israeli man wearing a Jewish kippah or skull cap while shouting Yehudi, Jew, in Arabic. A video of the street assault filmed by the victim on his smartphone has sparked widespread public revulsion as it spread on social media and triggered street rallies in solidarity with Jews. News of the belt attack coincided with another public outcry over a rap duo who made light of Nazi death camp prisoners, but went on to win the music industry's sales-based Echo Award, which was subsequently axed. Days after the belt assault, some 2,000 people rallied at a Berlin Wears Kippah solidarity demonstration, and and it was also matched by smaller events in several other German cities. So most anti-Semitic offenses were, however, committed by far-right perpetrators, reported the Berlin Daily Tagesspiegel. The Tagesspiegel means the Daily Mirror, in an article on the new crime statistics. Pau, P-A-U, in her statement, issued charge that rather that quote, we are seeing that military right-wing extremists can openly call for the desecration of Jewish institutions and attacks against Jewish people. A rising number of people and groups in the gray zone between conservation and right-wing extremism are denying the Holocaust and engaging in anti-Semitic algorithms, he said. So, my goodness, bear with me a moment. I want to see at our screen. All right, I'm going to just check, see if there's anything else that we can share with you in a moment. Bear with me a second. Okay. All right, I think we may just have the information from Iran that may be coming in. So bear with me a moment. One second. All right, let me just see. Okay. I don't see it here, so it doesn't look like we have any more information yet about what happened in Iran. So we'll just have to see what else is happening here. Let's just quickly go back to see what else is happening in Europe. All right. All right, this is going to be interesting because it speaks to the Spanish prime minister who's under pressure after the parliament has rejected his budget. So let's listen to this. Bear with me a moment.
Zoic, turning data into better experience.
Well, for the very latest on this, let's go live now to France 24, Sarah Morris, who joins us from Madrid. Sarah, earlier I spoke to the Catalan foreign minister, who said that they don't necessarily have to do snap elections now that that budget has been defeated. How else could this play out?
Well, in theory, the foreign minister of Catalonia is right. This could be rolled over the last year's budget, and the government could continue to run the country until 2020. But nobody expects that to happen. This is the second time a government has ever lost a budget vote in this way. And the last time that a government lost a budget vote was the Felipe González socialist government. After it lost a budget, it had to call early elections, and just by coincidence, it was also the Catalan nationalist parties that voted against that budget. So a similar situation Pedro Sanchez finds himself in, and now the eyes are on him. The prime minister is the only person who can set that date, and the dates are being rumoured are April 14th or the 28th, or a super Sunday in May to coincide with European and local elections. And now we understand that lots and lots of the local regional barons, as they're nicknamed in the socialist parties, who want to do well at those local elections, are asking Pedro Sanchez not to do a Super Sunday, to do an April date.
Sarah, this of course comes as there is that highly sensitive case going on now at the Spanish Supreme Court, a trial that's on with 12 Catalan separatists who have been linked to Catalonia's failed independence bid. What's the latest from the courtroom?
The latest is we've heard the public prosecutor speaking about the remarks made yesterday by the defendant's lawyers. The defendant's lawyers yesterday had said that they couldn't get a fair trial. And the prosecutor told the court today they can get a fair trial, that this is an impartial court. And he said their strategy was to belittle and to rubbish the Spanish justice system. He said that they were not on trial for being pro-independent supported. They were on trial for the events of 2017 when they broke the constitution and broke the orders from the court that that referendum on October the 1st should not go ahead. The prosecutor will continue making his rebuts to their remarks, and we don't expect to hear the first witnesses until potentially tomorrow.
Sarah, thank you for that. Sarah Morris reporting for us from Madrid.